Socialist Party in War is the title of the talk. It wasn't my choice. We had a bit of a rush on to try and think of something before the deadline for the Standard. But it does the job. What we've just heard, as Simon said at the end of his talk, is an empirical history of regional geopolitics regarding the Middle East region and oil resources. What I'm going to be talking about is the history of science, with particular regard to the history of socialist science and the understanding of war. And what I mean by science, I mean by investigating the general underlying principles which can be applied to phenomena observable in the world, as observed by the Socialist Party through its debate and through its propaganda and through its intervention in that world. So what I'm going to look at initially is I'm going to look at the conditions of socialist thought when the Socialist Party, our Socialist Party, was founded. I'm not going to go into detail about the policies and principles of Marx and Engels, largely because it's been done elsewhere at very great depth, not least by the Socialist Party itself, in a document which I'll circulate via the internet, if anyone wants to get their hands on it, or head office will have available. But what I'm going to talk about is some of the ideas that were current about war when the Socialist Party was founded, what the Socialist Party said about war in the immediate aftermath of its foundation, and how it applied its principles and its whole reason for being to its policy about war. I'm then going to look at some very early instances of intervention in specific wars. I'll start with the Russo-Japanese War, which was basically happening more or less straight after the party was founded. I'm going to look at World War I and what the party said about World War I and how it interacted with it. And I'm going to look at various important historical events that have founded and shaped left thought, in fact, world thought, from the early half of the 20th century, not least the Easter Uprising, Zionism, and the Bolshevik coup in Russia. I'm then going to look at how the party's position with regard to war developed through the 1930s and was applied specifically in the heated debate around the Spanish Civil War. I'll then culminate basically with the party arriving at its position on the Second World War, which, barring the minor matter of the party statement on violence, which actually isn't a statement about war as such, culminated in the party policy on war that is still extant and which we apply to war today, such as the war in the Middle East. So if you forgive me a second. As you may or may not know, the Socialist Party of Great Britain was founded by a group of people who split away from an organisation called the Social Democratic Federation, which was dominated by two particular members, H.M. Hyman and Harry Quelch. Now, they had something to say about war. There was a war going on around about 1900, which is the British Boer War in southern Africa. Now, what Hyman and co. had to say about that war was that it was a war that was promoted by Jewish jingles who owned capital here and had no intrinsic loyalty to the British people. This provoked immense amounts of controversy on the left. It forced people like James Connolly to break away from the SDF and condemn it outright for its anti-Semitic idea. Now, of course, with this, the idea behind this was that Jews were nationless and that they, because they were capitalists, they were manipulating their ownership of the press to fight a war in their interest. It wasn't in the true interests of the British people. And that's the organisation that we basically split away from. This we, I mean, obviously, socialist we. The we that was not, that was, should have been excluded from the we in the previous talk. But we split away from the SDF precisely over this kind of reactionary politics, this kind of nationalism and jingoism as promoted by Hyman, which eventually led him to form the British Socialist Party and to be a national socialist. Now, almost immediately, in January 1905, the Socialist Standard had an article headed Peace on Earth, in which they execrated various priests and bishops for their wishy-washy pie-in-the-sky belief and saying, peace on earth, can't we all just get along and love one another? And the columnist in the Socialist Standard said, if we take but a short 10-year period, we shall find that every civilised country engaged either in war or in oppressing subject races, America with Spain and with the Filipinos, France with Madagascar and Algeria, Russia with Japan and the Manchus, Germany with the Hereros, Holland with the Javanese, Britain everywhere. Thus the tale of war is told. Now, I think it's significant to the fact that how unexceptional war is that I've no idea who the Hereros were. It's a name forgotten to history, but someone fought a war against them and probably many thousands died in that war. But it's obviously gone down as an obscure footnote in history.
The Namibians.
The Namibians, thank you, comrade. There you go, we have a fountain of knowledge at the front. And essentially, I mean, it's entirely telling that basically for the last 200 years, We have been, in Britain alone has been in constant war. It's in our lifetimes, you know, there's been war in Northern Ireland, war in South Pacific, or South Atlantic, several wars in the Gulf. Almost continually, since I was born, the British state has been at war. And what the columnist in the Socialist Standard pointed out was that war today is essentially commercial, and at all times has been at base economic. Now, what he meant by commercial, not just capitalists, he didn't single out capitalists, he was pointing out that the wars were fought over trade routes, resources, and populations and strategic positions, and markets, obviously, to sell the goods in. That they were wars fought in the interests of commerce, they weren't just fought in interest of imperial prestige, or in interest of dynastic politics, they were fought to further commerce. And that has been a fundamental principle which the Socialist Party has applied to all the wars it has observed since the Socialist Party was itself founded. So if you take the example of the Japanese-Russian War, this was two near-capitalist or emergent capitalist states coming into collision with one another and fighting precisely over all those trade routes, resources, and strategic positions that were available to them in that small sphere of the world which they joined, which is the same situation as you previously heard for the Middle East. And what the Socialist Standard had to say in an article called The Curse of National Prestige from August 1905 was, we know that whichever side wins is but a win for capitalism. Because, as the columnist pointed out, whichever side won would use its victory to promote its industry, to promote its commerce, to promote the spread of wage slavery and industrialisation. And that no matter what happened, it would mean that capitalist competition on a worldwide scale would be developed and increased, and it would be a direct attack on the working class of the entire world. That's what the communist meant by that comment even. He further went on to say, it was almost certainly a he, a very important principle of the socialist position on war, one again that we maintain to this day. Were Germany to conquer France, or France conquer Britain, he, the worker, my comment, would be ruled by no more an alien class than that which rules him today. That is, we have nothing in common with our capitalist masters. We have no national interest in common with them. We have no position in common with them. This principle is enshrined in our Declaration of Principles, and that we say that there is a conflict going on between them as own the means of production and them as work upon the means of production, and that this antagonism is irreconcilable and can only be ended by the successful revolution of the working class. To that end, our columnist in the Socialist Standard of 1905 stated boldly, he should fight only for his class emancipation, meaning the conquered worker. That was the position. From very early on, from the start, the Socialist Party members applied the policies and principles to state that workers have no interest in any war other than the class war. In fact, they went so far as to occasionally point out most of the tight discussions on war would eventually lead to a discussion of the horrors of peace. They'd say, whereas tens of thousands might die in a particular battle, in a particular war, tens of thousands are dying through starvation, tens of thousands are dying or being maimed in the factories, that the horrors of peace are equal to the horrors of war and they're just as worth fighting against as war in particular. So we come to the outbreak of World War I, and I have with me a couple of visual aids. Some of you may recognise this. We keep using it as a leaflet. That's the war and the socialist position, in which the party clearly stated the well-often repeated phrase, having no quarrel with the working class of any country, we extend to our fellow workers of all lands the expression of our goodwill and socialist fraternity and pledge ourselves to work for the overthrow of capitalism and the triumph of some socialism, the world for the workers. That was our immediate position on World War I being started. This was immediately followed up the following month, I hope. Let's just check. October. Yes, following month, with a recruitment drive for the Greater War, by which they meant the class war, the war to abolish capitalism and for the triumph and emancipation of the working class. Now, the section I want to draw your attention to in this, the working class have no country. They must go where they can get a job, nor have they any liberties which it would hurt them much to lose. Now, it has to be remembered that at the time of writing, most of these socialists would have experienced anti-socialist policing on the streets, moving on street corner speakers, making it impossible to have meetings. Most of them probably wouldn't have the vote. They're still not even a universal male franchise, never mind universal female franchise. And so for them, even democracy was not so worth a phrase worth fighting and dying for. And it's that, I suggest, will form an important part in the debates that would follow in the ensuing years after World War I. Now, what they were doing here, again, was applying the Declaration of Principles. And in one article in April 1915, they point out that the armed forces of the state will only be set in motion to further the interests of the class who control them, the master class. And as the workers' interests are not bound in the struggle for markets, wherein their masters may dispose of the wealth they have stolen from the workers, but in the struggle to end socialism, the system under which they are robbed. Could someone delete that from the tape later, please? clearly stating, I mean, our Declaration of Principles state that the state exists to preserve the monopoly of class ownership on behalf of the master class, and in particular, the armed forces of that state exist to that end. And they will only be used, according to the socialist right in this article, to further that end, to prop up and promote the property interests of our master class, no matter what they may either contradict themselves think or say in public. And particularly, what we have to bear in mind is, not only is the state an interest of the master class, that means that if you partake in war, you are actively collaborating with the master class and actively hindering the cause of socialism, even at the very least, by promoting the capitalist military forces which are used to oppress us. And now this came to the fore in 1916 when the government began its conscription drives. At first they just conscripted the unmarried young men, the relatively surplus workforce, and then they came to the working men with families and they said, well, we're going to have you as well, and they basically sent everyone under the age of about 30 out to fight and die. And what the Socialist Standard said about conscription was that they would not join in the anti-conscription campaigns because the object should be to fight for socialism against capitalism as a means to end the system that breeds war, rather than merely being anti-conscription and leaving intact the very warlike system which produced the conscription drives. The propaganda in this war began more and more to focus on the worsening conditions of the workers at home. Now, this wasn't just down to the fact that changing economic needs meant that production was changed away from gearing from home consumption, such as it was, but to war production. But that, and this is the telling and most important point, the class war continued to be waged by the capitalists even during the so-called national unity of the Great World War. And they fought to drive down wages and to worsen working conditions as best they possibly could, while at the same time asking the workers in the name of national unity not to strike, not to fight back, and not to wage their side in the class war. Now, of course, this is because, irrespective of their personal wishes or desires, the class war, and particularly on the capitalist side, is a big impersonal force, which, regardless of whether or not they want it to, will have the effects of trying to lower wages as far as they humanly and possibly can go. So that's the sort of propaganda we get from the First World War and the socialist position towards it. And obviously there's a slight change here from this previous position, which is capitalist peace is as bad as capitalist war, to going, well, capitalist war is actually pretty bad and worth stopping outright in its own right. And therefore we can look at some of the events that drew out of the political crisis caused by the First World War. Now, as I stated, in 1916, the war abroad meant that there was an opportunity for Irish nationalism to try a military adventure in Dublin. And you get the Irish uprising there. That's Easter, so that's April 1916, is it? Yes, it's that time of year, it's 1916. Well, the 1916 August 1916 Socialist Standard came out clearly and unambiguously against the nationalist uprising on two counts. First off, it was a logical position of its logical extension of its anti-war position. Of being against war in particular, you're going to have to be against nationalist uprisings and nationalist wars of self-liberation, so-called. But it also extended to the principle that not only do workers not have any interest in where the nationalist boundaries are drawn, as we saw in the previous talk, clearly it's an interest of the capitalist class where the boundaries are drawn, but also that any such nationalist revolution is going to bring about a national government. And the continued existence of a government means a continued existence of domination, means a continued existence of capitalism, and the continued existence of suppression and exploitation of the working class, which any organisation claiming to stand for socialism must inevitably be opposed to. And so they opposed the Easter Uprising. And likewise, in 1918, they published an argument against Zionism on precisely the grounds that Zionism would simply lead to Jewish capitalists exploiting Jewish workers. and saying that Jewish workers should rather fight for world socialism, for the Commonwealth and for the world, for the workers, rather than for their own patch of land somewhere in the Middle East. The other significant consequence of the Great War was the Bolshevik coup in Russia and the uprisings and revolutions that were fought out there. And contrary to what some writers think, who think we just blanket, automatically, no thinking, declared it was rubbish and rejected the Bolshevik revolution and the coup over there on the eve, if you actually read the articles, you'll see that they were carefully considered, cautious, bearing in mind that the lack of actual facts to their hand that a socialist trying to describe and interpret events out there could come to. However, we have this. In what was called an astounding achievement, the Socialist Standard told us that whatever may be the final outcome, the Bolsheviks have at all events succeeded where all the armies, diplomats, all the priests and primates, all the pervid pacifists of the groaning and bleeding of the world have failed to do. They have stopped the slaughter, for the time being at any rate, on their front. That is, the Socialist Party, the Socialist Standard, actively welcomed the end of war as an end in itself on that front, because war was seen at this time already to be intensely against the interests of the working class, and stopping war was therefore in the interests of the working class per se. And following on after the First World War, the next, I think, significant thing to draw out of the Socialist Standard is that there was a multi-part article on aerial warfare, which for the first time as part of this in relation to new events, was dealing with the fact of total war. The idea now that you could send bombers into the air and kill people from a very great distance and attack civilian populations and industrial infrastructure. They had to deal for the first time with the fact that modern war is total war. No longer the warfare as known by Marx and Engels or people in the 19th century, of the warfare of gentlemen officers with a few gentlemen fighting, running around in a field in silly costumes, but now a war in which civilians were not only considered to be legitimate targets, but necessarily were legitimate targets because the industrial process was part of the whole war machine. Now, obviously, in the aftermath of the First World War, there was an extension of the franchise. There was the defeat of various reactionary regimes across Europe, and there followed 20-odd years of the utmost horrendous turmoil. However, this change meant now, contrary to the statement there that the workers have precious few liberties worth defending, there were a great many workers now who had at least nominally freedom of speech, who had at least nominally the franchise all across Europe. And when push came to shove, there was a fight back on behalf of the capitalist class that came in Spain. Now what happened in the Spanish in Spain was there was a largely liberal capitalist government with some Labourites, some anarchists and some Trotskyists that came to power as part of the Popular Front against the right-wing governments and the previous powers behind the dictatorship that had existed under Primo Rivera. And immediately upon that, the generals, who were part of the landed aristocracy and landed class, who again didn't like, as in Iran, having their land taken away from them and having it reformed, launched a coup and tried to take over the country. And of course, because you had successful fascism in Germany and Italy, this particular military organisation declared itself to be fascist. And this counter-coup, this attempt to overthrow an elected liberal democratic government, was initially met in the Socialist Standard by them, I quote, "We pay tribute to the Spanish workers who had risen up to defend the results of the election, even if it wasn't necessarily a socialist election." And indeed, writers in the Socialist Standard stated that this is the refutation to all of those who say that a simple electoral victory on our part will not be enough. See here how the workers have risen to defend the electoral result. That was the initial first response. And it's always something I think of when someone says that the Socialist Party has never supported any war, that the first response of the writers of the Socialist Standard was to support the side of the government, effectively, in Spanish Civil War. That was their initial response. Now, this was hardly an uncontroversial decision and led to a massive amount of debate within the party, and to lots of revisions in this position. Because, obviously, they were supporting, therefore, would be supporting a capitalist regime, which would inevitably going to be suppressing its own workers, and also, you know, fighting or supporting the massive amount of bloodshed in Spain. And the party also did initially emphasise that one of the reasons why the war had been started, a very interesting part of party history and thought, was precisely because of the deep divisions between the workers in the first place, because the workers are split between the anarchists and the Trotskyists in the POUM or whatever it was, and the official communists and the official socialist party and what have you. So after a long debate, at least 4 or 5 EC meetings where they kept on having to adjourn because it was just too late and they go, we'll put it to the front of the agenda next week. Yeah, an EC member recognises the feeling.
That was every week.
Yes. Eventually, the editorial committee of the Socialist Standard was asked to come up with a statement on the SPGB and Spain, which I have, by the very good grace of the head office organiser there, managed to get typed up into electronic format, which I'll send to Spincom later, but I have here copies which will be distributed after the talk. And I won't read it all out, because it is quite long and wordy. But I just want to draw attention to a couple of points. First off, they made an important, well, I don't know if it's a change in policy, but it's an important statement in policy that the Socialist Party as a party exists solely for the aim of achieving socialism. But what individual members of that party may do is a slightly different matter. And as a matter of fact, certainly according to the oral history of the party, I wasn't there, some members did go off to Spain to fight. And this was facilitated by the fact that the party had a rule saying if you left the country, you were out of the party. So they didn't have to be expelled for going to fight in the war. They could be just conveniently written off, you left the country, and when they come back to the country after the war, they could rejoin without any theoretical problems. Kind of a bit of a dirty fudge. But this whole statement is quite fudgy. He's trying to reconcile two very difficult positions, which is, how do you reconcile the idea, the desire to defend the working class as a class struggle organisation when the class fights a civil war to defend a capitalist liberal democratic regime, with also our understanding that you can't support capitalist regimes because they're inevitably going to turn around and, as they pretty much did, suppress the working class, and also our desire to defend democracy. And that's what this whole document tries to reconcile with this eventual fudge, that the party will only give support to socialist organisations, but it will wholeheartedly support the workers in their struggles unless it thinks that those struggles are perhaps a little bit misguided. It's important to note that this was, as a debate within the party, very important from the position of what the party is. Because if you are a materialist party, as we are, that believes that the working class is the agent of socialism and the agent of change, then that means that you have to support the working class in its struggle, at least to some extent, particularly in a struggle of a political magnitude such as fighting for the franchise, when we believe as a party that the franchise is one of the key means of bringing about the revolution. On the other hand, you have possibly the route to utopianism, which says that we believe in socialism, and if the workers aren't fighting for what we call socialism, well, tittle them, because we know what socialism is and they should be fighting for that, and that's the route off to utopianism. And this was here trying to reconcile the belief or the idea of trying to maintain a purely socialist organisation in material circumstances that were not conducive to those sorts of ideas, on which eventually comes to the position of we will give our support to workers, but we will also state, in the light of this change between previous gentlemanly war and modern total war, that the SPGB affirms its belief that war is not an instrument that can be used by socialists or supported by socialists. That is, the war in Spain not a suitable means of bringing about socialist emancipation and would only ever be and have capitalist consequences. So there's that statement, and it will be available for anyone who wants it at the end. Not during, because you just sit and read rather than listen to me. However, that statement was more or less a retraction of the previous support expressed for the war in Spain. And so the Socialist Party now officially did, and always had, opposed the war. And we can say with legitimacy that the Socialist Party has always supposed wars, all wars in the previous century and in the current. And this came to the Second World War, where this question of defending democracy, defending freedom against dictatorship and fascism again reared its head. And there was debates in the party. Now, the first party, the first debate, was initiated by someone, I couldn't write his name down, who basically asked the question, does the party actually have a policy on war? Do we have a policy on war? Do we oppose it? Or is it our policy business as usual? Because we believe in the continuation of the class war and we just believe in fighting for socialism irrespective of whether our particular government is at war at a given time or not. Now, implicitly, actually, I would argue that that is, by our own declaration of principles, an anti-war position, because the continuation of class war means basically directing resources, particularly from the state and the military, away from the front, to try and police the class war at home. So effectively, it was a non-argument. But anyway, there was lots of members of the party had to line up, and the EC lined up and said, no, we do have a position, we are opposed to war. We are against wars and we'll use any means at our disposal as a party, which will presumably mean instructing our delegates in parliament and local councils to vote against the war. But this all led, there was various interventions by Manchester branch and various other branches over the discussion, should we be supporting the war in Europe against fascism, against the dictatorship, in favour of democracy? Much the same debate as happened in Spain. And eventually this led to a conference resolution, as far as I know the only extant conference resolution on war itself, which is the attitude and report on the conference to war on the conference and a statement on the party's attitude to war. Now, the actual report is very long and contains a very long discussion on Marx and Engels' position towards war, the various wars that they lived through, in counterposing to the party's position. Now, I didn't want to give that up today because it is a bit too long and I had to pay for these photocopies myself. But I will make that available via Spin.com and again via head office should anyone want to request it. The head office organiser will be all too happy to oblige, and one over there as well. Right. Now, this sets out three key premises for the analysis of war on behalf of a socialist party in action. Has the proposed action the purpose of achieving socialism, and will it achieve that result? Has the proposed action the purpose of safeguarding democracy, and will it have this result? Has the proposed action the purpose of achieving an improvement in the conditions of the workers, and will it achieve this result? Now, it's point two that I want to draw your attention to, because that's the part of my narrative, which is this question of, do we defend democracy? What is our position on wars for democracy? And I'll read out the whole of the section regarding that. With regard to two, it is claimed on the Allied side that the war has the purpose, and victory will achieve the result, of safeguarding and even extending democracy. The Socialist Party now, as throughout its history, holds this line of argument is fallacious, and that this war, like the war 1914 to 1918, will not have the result, nor as far as it concerns the prime motives of those who control the government of Britain and France, is that the purpose of this war. This statement was drawn before the French government fell. While we are anxious, as anyone, to see all forms of dictatorship destroyed, we hold that war will not secure that object. On the contrary, with the workers of all countries in their existing backward political state, the direct and immediate consequences of war and the suffering and hatreds accompanying war will weaken and undermine democracy, not strengthen it. This is true even though the defeat of Germany might, as in 1918, temporarily cause the openly reactionary forces to give up their hold on the machinery of government. It is not impossible that a prolonged war may even give the opportunity to anti-democratic organisations in the Allied countries. Thus, they reconciled the apparent contradiction between the party's desire not to fight on the side of the capitalist state with the need or our apparent need for political democracy by saying, fairly bluntly, that war as a political means doesn't particularly produce democratic results. And we can actually see this in the aftermath of the Second World War. Ended up with Germany under occupation with a stitch-up constitution in the West and a dictatorship in the East, half of Europe under the Bolshevik dictatorship, various little faction fights in Italy and Greece to keep control of those countries within various imperial spheres of orbits, and two fascist dictatorships remaining in place in Portugal and Spain. So anyone who would claim that the Second World War was fought to establish democracy across Europe would clearly be contradicted by the facts and by the inevitable results of what happened when policy has been made via the imposition of warfare. And of course, the results at home, in terms of the massive extension of the state and state control during the war, was applied after the war as well, and continued on through keeping rationing including rationing and ID cards and various schemes of social control that remained in place for a good 10 years after the war was over. And so you can say fairly clearly that the political results of the war at home was a worsening for that very living room and breathing space that the statement on Spain talks about on behalf of the working class and what they should be fighting for. And I'll just briefly mention, as I mentioned earlier, that the next excellent thing on, I suppose, on war is the statement on violence in the 1970s, which is not a statement on war as such, but a statement with regards to what a socialist majority would do to defend its own position, which really hasn't changed since the comments on Spain, which is they would use violence if and when necessary to defend the democratic mandate of a socialist revolution. So I'm just going to quickly run through the arguments, the scientifically derived principles about war that the parties obtained through long years of argument and struggle and analysis of the world. First off, as I just mentioned, is it strengthens the state at home, and indeed abroad, by strengthening the military and by strengthening the whole willingness of the working class to submit to the state during times of war. And this submission to the state doesn't tend to get eroded after the war. It's a diminution in productive resources. It eventually leads to either production being directed towards war production rather than towards satisfying needs, or actively means the bombing of factories and the killing of workers who could do useful work and help bring about socialism through that production. The class war continues, irrespective of whether or not the capitalist class say that there is a true son and that we should all unite to defend the motherland or whatever. And total war means now that all workers share in the burden of the war, not just those who happen to get sent to the front, and that means that we are all threatened and enslaved by the militarisation of our society to fight that sort of war. And those are the reasons why I'd say, in general, the Socialist Party has always taken a stance against war. So just to go run through what we've seen here, the Socialist Party has always been against war. Right from its very foundation, it stood against those in the left movement who were for the defence of the nation or for war under whatever excuse that they might have chosen to claim for it. We have always said that all wars are fought in the interests of capitalism and the interests of capitalists. We've said that national liberation wars are of no use to the workers, but that ending war as such is a legitimate aim of a socialist organisation and that we should use every means at our disposal to fight against wars. And we've also seen that wars for democracy are logically contradictory and are not directly in the interest of the working class, and we have no support for so-called liberal democratic wars against fascism. And that, I would suggest, is the party's position on war, and that's what the Socialist Party in war is all about. Cheers.
Thanks very much. Well presented.